The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
This is fun for me. I'll just say it up front. I get to talk to someone I consider a friend because he's very generous in that way, Dr. John Lennox, professor of mathematics at Oxford, the author of innumerable books from which I have quoted in my books. Dr. Lennox, dear friend, thank you for being on the program.
That's a great pleasure, as always, to join you. And I can see that you, like me, are locked down. York and me in Oxford.
There are worse things than being locked down in one's own apartment, because it just means that I don't have to get on the subway. What's so terrible about that?
I found it a huge opportunity to do many of these interviews. And I think we're in the 80s now in terms of interviews since lockdown for me.
Wow. Well, good for you. Terrific. I want to talk to you, of course, about your brand new book. You have a brand new book out called 2084 that is doubtless a reference to 1984, and in 2084, you talk about artificial intelligence and the future of humanity. That's the subtitle, 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity. I have to say that, you know, knowing you as I do and knowing your books as I do, I was surprised that you decided to leap in to the subject for a whole book. What led you to leap into the subject?
Oh, quite a few different things, actually. The springboard that precipitated the writing of the book was being invited to give a talk on artificial intelligence and the nature of humanity. And I, first of all, said, no, I don't really feel I'm not a pioneer worker in AI, though I'm interested in it. And they said, but you're also interested in Genesis and its teaching on the nature of human beings, and we'd like you to do it. So I reluctantly agreed, then did a lot of reading and realized very rapidly that this demands a serious book, because most of my life, actually, I have been interested in the interface, as you know, between science, theology, and philosophy. And of course, one of the key questions that faces everybody is what they think a human being is. And because of the advances in science and technology, we're now in a position to do things not only to individual human beings, but even potentially to the human race that would alter it permanently. And therefore, that raises the question in an acute form. And of course, AI is one of the directions in which people are going. And there are all kinds of futuristic ideas out there. And here's another precipitating factor for me, the immense success of the books of Yuval Noah Harari, particularly his second book, Homo Deus. He wrote a book called Sapiens about human origins. But then he wrote Homo Deus about the future of humanity. And when I read that, noticing, by the way, it's not written by a scientist, but by a historian, I thought someone needs to respond to this. Well, many people probably have responded to it, but I thought perhaps it might be important, granted the extent to which he speculates about the future, to bring Christianity to bear on it in the hope of showing that Christianity is something intelligible and communicable and interesting and valid to say about it.
Well, let's go there, because I've heard of Yuval Noah and those books, but I have not read them. What does he say? Where is he coming from? And what does he say in those books to which you felt a need to respond?
He's coming from a strong atheistic perspective, but he's analyzing culture. And he looks at culture and makes certain statements about it that are quite questionable, such as war is decreasing and all this kind of stuff. But what focused my mind was his agenda as he regards it for the 21st century. The two main agenda items, he says, are one, dealing with physical death. We're now in a position, he says, death, physical death is a technical problem. Technical problems have technical solutions. So what we're going to do in the 24th century is solve physical death from a medical perspective. Now, what he means by that is that humans will still die, but they won't have to die. There'll be a solution to the death problem. Then the second agenda item is, what are we going to do with these humans? And he says, we're going to enhance their experience of happiness. How are we going to do that? We're going to change them. We've already reached beyond the stage of animals. We've developed minds and consciousness. But now we're intelligent enough to take this whole process into our own hands and start to remodel humanity, which is in flux anyway, according to their atheistic and materialistic presuppositions. And we're going to add all kinds of things, technology, drugs, biogenetic engineering, all this kind of thing. And we're going to raise human beings way above the state they're at now. So we're going to produce out of Homo sapiens, Homo Deus, the man who is God. Now, of course, there are all kinds of ancient ideas behind that, but that's the agenda. And I thought, half a minute, something needs to be said about this, because this feeds into some of the most ancient motivations behind human existence that there are.
You're talking about something which, to my mind, inevitably brings up from the first chapters of Genesis this satanic promise, ye can be as gods, or ye shall be as gods. It seems to me that it's like we've been allowed via technology to create a new kind of Tower of Babel, that what you're talking about is trying to reach the heavens on our own strength, on our own accord, to reach the heavens without God, and that folks like Yuval Noah, they sense this, and they see it as there's an irony, right? Because they claim to be strict materialists, where they don't seem to believe in a purpose, but at the same time they operate in a way as though random evolution, they would say, blind Darwinian evolution, has led us to this moment, and we have to seize it. It's kind of a Promethean thing. I mean, there's a lot that comes into it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And the biblical background is entirely appropriate, because the scene as depicted in the beginning of Genesis is extremely sophisticated and, in one way, simple to understand. It's a human rebellion against God, but it is done in such a form as to leave behind a trace that's flowed down all through history that God is against human beings. Now, Genesis paints a very different picture. God creates human beings and dignifies them with his own image, which is a very important thing. In fact, Jordan Peterson, not long ago, in his fascinating talks on Genesis, which are well worth watching, says, look, this statement, human beings made in the image of God, is the cornerstone of Western civilization. And then he breaks off and he said, man, you ignore this at your peril. It's hugely important. Now, going from there, we find the temptation story, the so-called fall of human beings when they rebelled against God. The temptation, we are told, was very subtle. It appealed to their aesthetic sense, their intellectual sense, and God had forbidden them to eat of one particular fruit. They could eat everything else. That's the basic parameters, the basic things that you need to have a moral dimension to life, something forbidden but the freedom to eat it. And the temptation came in the form that God knows in the day you eat that, you will be as gods, knowing good and evil. In other words, God is suppressing your flourishing. He's against you. And of course, God wasn't against them at all. The tree, which is so frequently said to be the tree of knowledge, was absolutely not the tree of knowledge. It was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And that was a knowledge you don't want to have. And of course, when they disobeyed God, they found that they'd ruptured the fundamental relationship that they had from God at the beginning. And that has its consequences all down through history, with this sense that many people have, particularly atheists, that God, if there is a God, is against them. He doesn't want them to rise to his level. And I, of course, wish to say, with the whole authority of Christianity behind me, that that is the lie. And so turning away from God as the source of life and immortality, the quest now comes, the ancient quest was for an elixir of life. There's a tree of life mentioned in Genesis, and God took it away from them when they rebelled. And those memories in folk memory, I think, are partly at least responsible for that search for an elixir of life, something that will convey on us living forever. And now you come straight into the 21st century, and the idea that death is a result of our biological involvement. If only we could get rid of that and upload the content of our brains onto silicon, something more permanent, we could solve the problem of immortality, and that would be a kind of elixir of life. So all of those ideas are flowing in, and they have a very powerful appeal to human beings. Think of the folks that have their bodies frozen when they die in the hope that this technology will be perfect in the next 40 or 50 years so that they can be reincarnated, so to speak, on silicon.
Well, isn't this the problem? Because we're talking about two different things, right? I mean, we're talking about many things, but specifically now, this dichotomy, they pretend that there's no dichotomy. They pretend that mind and brain are the same thing. There's no such thing as mind apart from our brain. So the idea that you can download one's brain, perhaps, but you can't download a mind. A mind is something apart from a brain. And if you're a strict materialist, you don't believe in a mind. You believe that if I can freeze my brain, that's me. There is no me apart from the physicality of my body and my brain. So clearly, they're mistaken in that. At least you and I know they're mistaken.
Yeah, I think it's very obvious that they're mistaken. For example, the brain story, my brain story or yours and mine story are obviously different. For example, I can tell you what's in my mind. And if you're a special kind of doctor, you can connect my brain up to various instruments and tell me something about what's in my brain. For example, what parts of it light up electrically when I see Eric Metaxas or something like this. But you cannot tell me my mind story. So you can tell me a bit about what's in my brain, but not my mind. I can tell you what's in my mind, but not what's in my brain. And that, to me, is enough. There's plenty of other evidence as well. And what has encouraged me, and I've written a bit about this, actually, because it interests me greatly, that people, serious thinkers in this area, like David Chalmers, are moving towards the kind of dualism that there is a mind and a brain, which has been rejected by so many people without really sufficient evidence to do so. The mind is much more complex than the brain, but they are clearly deeply connected. And we don't understand what the connection is. We don't know what consciousness is.
I was going to say, this is the key, right? In case anybody's not tracking with us, let's be clear that if somebody has an out-of-body experience, that's independent of one's brain. If I'm floating over an operating table watching them operate on me, that can have nothing to do with the pink tissue between my ears, which is on the operating table. My brain, my mind or my soul exists eternally independent of my body, which will one day rot. So this really does bring up many questions, and you just touched on the heart of it. Consciousness, the idea that we can have artificial intelligence, some kind of computer that can be incredibly smart, smarter than we ever could be. Perhaps we can achieve that with technology, but to achieve consciousness is to make a leap across an abyss that never can really be accomplished. But there are many people who seem to think that it can, who seem to think it's just a matter of time. I assume that Yuval Noah is one of them. Why would they suggest such a thing? On what basis? Do they have any evidence for this?
Well, of course, if you reduce mind to brain, you, in a way, give yourself more hope of doing that, as you suggested. But I think we need to step back from this slightly, because another reason I wrote this book was to deal with that aspect, but to point out that there are other aspects of artificial intelligence that are already working and are very beneficial and to be greeted. And this other stuff needs to be seen in that context. And let me give you an example of that. There are two kinds of AI. What we've been talking about up to now is called artificial general intelligence. That is super intelligence, inventing a system that can do everything a human can do, but do it much better. In other words, super intelligence. But normal, narrow AI is the capacity of a system that consists of a computer, a program, and a huge database to do a single task. Sorry about that.
If that's my wife, I'm not here.
Okay, let me start that again, all right?
Sure.
Narrow artificial intelligence is the capacity of a system which consists of a computer with a lot of crunching power, a database, and it deals with one single problem. Example, x-rays of lungs. You take a million x-rays. There's your database. But they're labeled by the top lung doctors in the world with their respective diseases. Then I get problems with my lungs and an x-ray is taken. The AI system compares my x-ray with the million x-rays, recognizes the pattern, and prints out that Lennox has got this particular disease. Now, this kind of AI has been developed to such an extent, it's putting out diagnoses that are significantly better than what you'd get at your local hospital, and much faster, because you're really harnessing the ability of the top doctors who may live thousands of miles from you, and they're applied to your case. Now, this is marvelous and is going to help with medical diagnostics to a vast degree. And the same thing applies to the search for vaccines for COVID-19, the search for new medicines, all that kind of thing. That is really positive stuff. Now, there is a negative side even to the AI that already is operating. For example, facial recognition technology can be used to recognize criminals and arrest them, but it can also be used to create a surveillance state, as we read is being created in Xinjiang in China, where the surveillance is just beyond almost all belief, but it is operating at this very moment. And there are voices in the West that want to introduce this in our countries as well.
Dr. Lennox, you just brought up the thing that I was going to bring up, is that inevitably there comes a moral component. In other words, what we can do with science, with artificial intelligence, and I know you deal with this in your book 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity, what we can do is not necessarily what we should do. And so in doing science and working with technology, we human beings have to step in and make some decisions. And it seems to me that a strict scientistic materialist says, no, we can do anything we like to do. There is no ought. Those of us who know the sinful temptations that we as a fallen humanity face, we know that there are things that we can do or will be able to do which we should not do. And when you talk about the surveillance state in China, I mean, we're there now. What they're doing, there's even facial recognition technology that they have. I was talking to someone on my program about it with regard to one's emotions. In other words, things that we don't even dream of, that computers will be able to do, which will be used for evil ends. And so it seems to me that the thrust of your book and what you're saying is that we have to confront this. We can't pretend that it's all good, that there's a wickedness that can come into the equation, and it's already coming into the equation in the Chinese Communist Party and what they're doing.
Narrow AI that works is like a knife. You can use a knife for surgery to save somebody's life, or you can use it to stab them. And we're seeing both. I gave you an example in medicine, saving people's lives. But now with facial recognition, you can create the most advanced totalitarian and intrusive state imaginable. And you were mentioning some of the things that appear to be happening in China. They're rolling out the social credit program right across the nation, I understand it, where every citizen is given so many points. And you can add to your points by behaving according to the norms of the state. But if you do something that is not approved of, then you'll find that your credit card may be cancelled. You can't travel. You can't book a holiday. You may lose your job and all this kind of thing. Now, that is happening. They're putting up hundreds of thousands of new CCTV cameras over there. And what I found frightening in the Times article on this, the Time article on this, was people love it. Many people say, look how many points I've got, not realizing that what they're doing is sacrificing their freedom for alleged security. And that, of course, is the huge tension. And one of the leading police people in London, I believe, said that's what we need in London. And of course, back in the days of Stalin or Hitler, they would have rejoiced to have a system like this. So there are pluses and minuses. Facial recognition techniques, as you say, they can be used in a factory situation to monitor workers. And if there's any detection of any emotion that the authorities don't approve of, then that person can be called in. But think of what's happening just down the road from you in Boston. In MIT, there's Rosalind Picard, who's a Christian, a brilliant AI expert who's created a whole subject in her field called affective computing. And she's using facial recognition techniques on children who have certain diseases that make them liable to seizures and fits that can be life-threatening. And by these AI techniques, she's able to predict in certain cases when these seizures are going to happen and therefore to medically intervene and prevent them. So there's a wonderful positive use of the thing that is enslaving people, and in the case of the Uyghurs, is putting many of them into what look very like concentration camps at the moment. So yeah. The ethics, Eric, I would say this. The whole danger in this is all of these things depend on programming a computer. The ethics need to be built in, but those will be the ethics of the programmer. And the trouble is, it's obvious to everybody that technology is outpacing ethics by many factors. And that's what's alarming people like the late Stephen Hawking, like Elon Musk, and a number of these people who have got together thousands of signatures saying, hold on a minute, we need to develop basic agreed international ethical principles to regulate what we already have, to say nothing of what we might develop in the future.
It's extraordinary, I have to say. Well, first of all, we've had Rosalind Picard of MIT on this program, and we have to have her back because she's one of the few voices in that world with a biblical perspective. But when you talk about being outstripped by the technology we've created, I mean, of course, this has been something that we've always faced as a species. It's just that in a way now, I referenced the Tower of Babel, that we have abilities, in a sense, to do things undreamt of. I mean, it strikes me as something out of a C.S. Lewis novel, that when Lewis wrote in that Hideous Strength, he was beginning to talk about these kinds of capabilities and of the nefarious police state. It sounds to me like end time stuff. I'm not saying that it is, but it sounds to me like end time stuff in the biblical sense, because it's almost like a kind of final battle that we have people on the side, on one side, who say we must not do this and this and this because this is the nature of humanity. And then you have other people on the other side, very powerful people, powerful voices, who say, no, this is the nature of humanity, and therefore we can do this. So we've never been forced to focus so clearly on what is the nature of humanity in the way that we are now, it seems to me.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's a worldview question. By that, I mean that looking at this problem from the perspective of atheism, say, which says that human beings have no ultimate value, is very different from looking at it from the perspective, as I do and you, of Christianity, that says that human beings are made in the image of God. And the poignancy of it all and the urgency of it all is, as you say, that for the first time in history, we are now capable of doing what C.S. Lewis foresaw. That is getting involved in reprogramming, so to speak, our genetic inheritance and passing it on to all humans that follow us. I say humans because Lewis made such a powerful point in 1940 in his book, The Abolition of Man. He pointed out that when scientists get this kind of power to modify the generations to come. Now, you don't have to wait for artificial intelligence for that. We already appear to have it or be very near having it. Then in the end, what they create is not a human being. It's an artifact. And he says the final triumph of humanity will be the abolition of man. And that is a hugely serious thing, it seems to me, that against which we need to protest in a credible way. And I wish to protest very strongly. You say it's an end time scenario, and in a very real sense it is, because the issues are mounting up. But I want to say, look, your quest for immortality and eternal life through artificial general intelligence, well, you're too late, because eternal life is already on offer through trusting Christ, who was raised from the dead. The death question was solved 20 centuries ago, in a sense. And the wonderful thing about the gospel, and it gears straight into this, is that you can have eternal life, which will guarantee your uploading into heaven, to use that kind of language, as a free gift. You don't have to pay to have your body or brain frozen, costing millions of dollars. By trusting Christ, you receive that eternal life. And then, of course, the promise is that he, as the true Homo Deus, and here's the irony of it all, Eric, and I find this one of the most important points in this area. All of this stuff is a reaching, like the Tower of Babel. It's a reaching for heaven. It's an aspiring to be God. Christianity tells us that not that we can reach up to God, but that God reaches down to us. And the central Christian doctrine, the incarnation, is God becoming human. That's the movement in the opposite direction. God has become human in order that we can become sons and daughters of God. He gives us his life. So the central expectation of Christianity, which is a big topic, but it is the fact that this world hasn't heard the last of Jesus Christ, the true Homo Deus, the man who is God, will return. Now, that's a hugely different scenario from the ones advanced by Harari and Tegmark and these other people. And I want to say this. If we're going to take seriously all these scenarios of the future, many of which are dystopian, like 1984, then it's time to revisit the biblical scenario that at least has the advantage of having credible evidence to back it in terms of the life, death, and resurrection of Christ.
Well, you and I know that there's tons of credible evidence, but there are people who couldn't possibly comprehend that there might be such evidence. You've spent most of your life presenting that evidence. I'm trying to do something similar. It seems to me that those willing to look at the facts and willing to follow the logic will find themselves, if they have any kind of an open mind, stunned to see the evidence, stunned to see that the other side really has no evidence. It has a bully pulpit, has a lot of loud voices out there. But the fact of the matter is, if you're willing to look beyond the surface, beyond those voices, the evidence is just overwhelming. That's part of what I keep thinking about, John, is that the evidence is mounting for the biblical view from a scientific perspective. You know, we can talk about the fine-tuned universe. There was nothing to discuss 50 or so years ago, almost nothing. It's only in the last five decades that we have more and more and more evidence that what we have could not possibly have arisen without an intelligent mind behind it. And I think that as we make that case, some people will see that it's not only not as crazy as they thought, but that it's just shockingly plausible. Something that they thought couldn't possibly be real is reality itself.
Yes, I agree entirely. And I'm a scientist, and every scientific bone in my body approves of this. You see, I'm not ashamed at all of being both a Christian and a scientist. That the greatest of scientists, Newton and Kepler and Galileo and Clark Maxwell, were all believers in God. And it was that drove their science. They saw no contradiction because they were able to distinguish clearly between a scientific explanation of how things work and a creator that created the thing that does work, without whom there would be no universe for scientists to study.
Dr. Lennox, this stuff is so deep and so rich. We're really talking about meaning itself, about everything. And it's funny because we come to it by way of talking about artificial intelligence. You were talking about the great irony, I guess, that people want to reach, they want to reach the heavens. They want immortality. And you said, of course, that we can have that. That's the whole point of the Christian faith. But there's so many voices in the culturally elite circles, we can call them, who don't even suppose that what the Bible says might be true, or that Jesus could have risen from the dead. And I would argue that the evidence, as I said earlier, is so clear and overwhelming if you dare look at it. But that's kind of our problem, is that it's hard to get folks like that to look at it.
Yes, it can be hard to get people to look at it. And I've been working most of my life to think of ways of breaking that barrier, because unfortunately, the slate has been written on, and many people have the impression that Christianity has nothing to say and science has everything to say, which is why, by the way, I wrote a little book last year called Can Science Explain Everything? And you mentioned meaning. Now, this is crucial because the really great scientists, and among them I include the late Feynman, who was an American Nobel Prize winner for physics, absolutely, absolute genius. And he saw very clearly that science is powerful because it asks questions that to which there are, it asks a limited number of questions which it can answer, mainly concerned with how things work or the why of function, that is, why is this bit there, not there, and so on. But it cannot answer questions of ethics, for example, or morality. The laws of nature, as I think it was he who once said, don't come with a label, you should do this. But secondly, they don't answer the deepest longings of the human heart for meaning. And some very bright scientists, like another Nobel Prize winner, Erwin Schrödinger, made the point that science just doesn't deal with the question of meaning. So they've got to find meaning from somewhere. Now, one of the prejudices of the naturalistic worldview, which dominates the scientific academy these days, is there's no such thing as ultimate purpose or meaning. So the only meaning that we can derive is what we create ourselves. I don't rubbish that. I think that many people, for example, see meaning, and rightly so, in their children, and they see meaning in their work and all this kind of thing. But what saddens me is that there's no ultimate meaning or purpose. And when there are so many things in our universe that speak that there is transcendence, there's something beyond, this isn't all there is, I like to encourage people at least to follow that instinct. This was one of the things that led C.S. Lewis to Christianity. And to encourage people to open their minds, as you put it earlier, to consider the possibility that there is more to it than that. I mean, after all, no one could do science if they didn't trust their mind to give you a reasonable map of what's out there. How does that work?
We were just talking about the meaning of meaning, and you were saying that if somebody doesn't believe in transcendent meaning, if they don't believe in the Bible, they don't believe a God exists beyond this universe, this is all there is, they say, well, we have to create our own meaning. Now, the problem with that, it seems to me, is that they are contradicting themselves. In other words, if you say that we evolved via random mutation, via accidental processes into who we are today, then we have no value. There is no such thing as meaning. And if we confront that, we'll be like Albert Camus or Sartre. We will see the hopelessness and try to find a way out of it. But a lot of people aren't willing to see the bleakness of what they say they believe. They pretend that they can have it both ways, and what they do really is borrow from the meaning that they have. They don't question where it came from. They just grab it and they talk about this is important, a family's important, something's important, but they're not dealing with the fact that if this is all there is, then in fact there can be no meaning. They seem to want to have it both ways, and they aren't forcing themselves to deal with that.
Well, the way I would say that is quite simple, actually, that doing science involves believing that there's truth out there to be discovered and that it is accessible, at least in part, to the human mind. And it was Einstein, one of the greatest physicists or scientists of all time, who realized there was something amazing in that. And he said the most amazing, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. In other words, he saw there's a problem. How is it that a scientist with her mind looking at the universe can understand something and reduce it to mathematics. Now, I often discuss this with colleagues, and I say, look, you do science with what you call your brain. If you don't believe in the mind, tell me about the brain. And often they will say, well, the brain in the end is a product of a mindless, unguided process. And I often have said to people, and it's been very interesting to do this, if you knew that your computer that you use every day was the end product of a mindless, unguided process, would you trust it? And I've always forced an answer, gently, of course, but nevertheless, I forced an answer. And it's always been no. Now I say you have a problem because you're inconsistent. You're telling me that what you're doing science with, that you can't trust, really. Now, I have a reason for trusting my mind, at least in part, because it is ultimately the product of the vast intelligence of a personal God, as is the universe out there. And that's why the two match together. But you don't have that. In other words, your argument, your atheism, is not simply undermining Christianity. Well, of course, it tries to do that. It's undermining science. So here I sit as a scientist who is a Christian. The two sit together. And I'm suggesting to you that the conflict is not at all between Christianity properly understood and science properly understood, but the conflict, the deep conflict, as Alvin Plantinga's put it, is between science and atheism. That's where the conflict is. And I think it's very important to point these things out. Many people who take the grim view, as you called it, will say, as Dawkins did to me on one occasion, so far as I can remember, it's grim, but that doesn't mean that it's false. And I said, no, that's right, but it doesn't mean that it's true either. And so we need to investigate. And if people are interested in and looking for hope, and they ask Feynman's question, what is the meaning of it all? He's got a little book with that title. What is the meaning of it all? It's a hugely important question. And I do believe that humans are made with eternity in their hearts. And we are questing for a solution to this. And this is why we grab at a lot of this artificial general intelligence. Is this going to bring us hope? When all the time there's a message whose credibility has been growing over the last 20 centuries that really gives us not superficial answers, but deep answers that enable us to have hope that transcends the basic barrier, and that is the death barrier.
I want to bring up before we end that if people, sometimes the way we make our decisions in life, it happened to me. In other words, if we can see something particularly negative and horrifying, that can force us in the other direction. And I think if people don't see the positive side of this, they can look at the negative side, meaning that if you look at where does the worldview take you, if you say that we can do as we like, might makes right, this is all there is, if the human being is not transcendent and sacred and have infinite value, as the Bible says, what does it lead to? Well, we know that it leads to the Nazi death camps, and today it leads to Uyghur Muslims being taken by the Communist Party and treated as nothing, treated as creatures that can be used for their organs. We can make profit. In other words, it follows logically that if you believe there is no God, who dares to say to the communist leadership in China, you mustn't do that? On what basis? I think most of us, because we're created in God's image, we recoil at the horror of you using human beings in that way, in the way that we recoil at slavery or the slave trade or any of this kind of thing, and that we need to allow that revulsion to something to force us to see what it is, what that worldview is, and then to be open to the other worldview. In other words, I think there's some hope in that.
Well, I think there is, because if we follow that and realize that we revolt against this because we're moral beings, we then need to ask ourselves the question, where do these standards come from? You see, the fact that you and I and many millions of other people will revolt at this kind of stuff shows that we're responding to moral principles that are independent and outside of ourselves. Now, that's an intimation of transcendence. That's an evidence that we're morally made in the image of God, and that we recognize the difference between good and evil. And where we have to begin to look to put a brake on all of this is to say, look, if we follow the atheist route, then there is no absolute morality. Everything is relative, but it doesn't stop there, because morality will then be determined by power. And the people in power will be the white-suited scientists who have the programming power to modify human beings. And that is absolutely terrifying if they start doing it with no basic concept of what good and evil are. And so in the name of morality and in the name of civilization, we need to protest and begin to ask, look, where do these basic cornerstones of our civilization come from? And that brings me back to Peterson's remark on Genesis 1:26, human beings made in the image of God. He says, man, we're going to neglect that at our peril. And we are neglecting it at our peril in our contemporary society.
I'm sorry we have to end it there, but John Lennox, we will have you back as soon as possible. We've been talking around the subject of this book, 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity. And thank you for that. We'll have you back to talk about COVID and other things as soon as we can. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.